Now, an opinion issued by Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel yesterday countered a 2011 state Supreme Court case. It has some big implications for Wisconsin's waterways.
Schimmel's opinion would limit the power of the Department of Natural Resources to regulate high-capacity wells. It comes in the midst of an extended conflict involving the legislature, the state Supreme Court, private businesses, and environmental groups.
Joining us now to tell us more about the Attorney General's opinion is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
All right. There's a lot of pieces here, a lot of moving parts, and
yes,
a lot of players. Let's start with what we heard from the Attorney General. Who asked him for an opinion and why?
So who asked him for the opinion is Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who is, you know, the top Republican in the state assembly. And that is the state assembly, which, by the way, has grappled with this high capacity wells issue for a few years now. They've been trying to pass a bill that was kind of to the liking of the business community, but could also get the support of members in their caucus, and they haven't been able to do it. So Voss turned to Attorney General Brad Schimmel, a fellow Republican, and said, we want you to address a few questions about how far this 2011 Supreme Court ruling reaches when it comes to high-capacity wells.
Let's look at these wells for a moment before we get to the nitty-gritty of what's going on here. These are high-capacity wells. They're pumping a lot of water. What kind of things are these wells used for?
Yeah, so these are not the wells that are, providing the water for a house,
yeah,
for example. I mean, these are for large businesses that have high water demands, a common user and somebody with a real big stake in what's happening in the high-capacity well debate in Wisconsin. Our potato and vegetable growers, the Dairy Business Association is a player in this, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association, anybody who has a big water demands as part of their business uses these high capacity wells. And in the Central Sands region, where they're used extensively, you're seeing a lot of lakes, nearby lakes, that are dropping their water tables, drying up.
Right. And right now, if I want to start a well, I got to go to the DNR, right? I got to file for a permit. As of previously, anyway, the DNR could say, we're going to look at those water levels that you just mentioned, Sean, and see if this new well, right, would have an impact on that.
Yeah, so the case that we were talking about a minute ago, the 2011 Supreme Court race, gave the DNR pretty broad authority to evaluate this and to look at what a high-capacity well would do to nearby waterways. So, you know, just looking at some of the wording from that 2011 Supreme Court, 7-0 decision, by the way, from a conservative Supreme Court. They said, quote, DNR has the authority and a general duty to consider whether a proposed high capacity well may harm waters of the state. And just in very explicit language over and over again in this opinion, really a full-throated defense of the state's public trust doctrine, which basically says that the waters of the state shall be common highways and forever free.
Now, that's 2011, a state Supreme Court decision. Also in 2011, the legislature did something that ended up being part of this opinion. What happened there?
They did. It was kind of a huge step by the legislature, and a very boring one to talk about, but very important. And they rewrote how rules are drafted in Wisconsin. And rules are basically carry the force of law. They're the fine details of law. They're written by agencies to carry out a law, basically. And so what the legislature did with this law that they passed back in 2011 is they reduced the power of agencies to draft rules that aren't specifically laid out by the legislature and the governor. So really gave the legislature more power and reduced the power of agencies.
And so Attorney General Brad Schimmel gets called by the assembly who want to tackle this high-capacity well issue. What did he decide about the DNR's ability to regulate high-capacity wells, the use of this public trust doctrine? What did he have to say about that Supreme Court decision?
So what he essentially said is there's no way the Supreme Court fully considered this law that the legislature passed that changed the rulemaking process, because if the court had considered that, it wouldn't have reached that decision. I mean, he says that through those changes to the law, the public trust duty reverts back to the legislature, which is responsible for making rules and statutes necessary to protect the waters of the state. and that it was up to the legislature, not the DNR, to decide how these get applied.
You've got a Supreme Court decision there in Courier Font, a big stack of paper. Does that decision refer to this act from the legislature?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty plainly does. It says we have considered this law and it doesn't change our decision at all. So it's not like the Supreme Court was unaware of what was happening in the legislature at the time. They made note the fact that this new rulemaking process had changed. They said it didn't change their decision. And so it's pretty remarkable that Attorney General Schimmel came out with this opinion yesterday. He did kind of make reference to that footnote in the Supreme Court opinion and said, you know, clearly they didn't give it the full consideration that it deserved.
We'll hear what this opinion from the Attorney General could change here in the state in just a few minutes as we talk to WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, looking at an opinion issued by Wisconsin's Attorney General aiming to limit the DNR's power to regulate high-capacity wells.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have high-capacity wells in your community, and how do they affect you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think that the DNR should consider the impact on local waterways before signing off on a new well? And do you see easing up on regulations helping Wisconsin businesses? Call 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about an opinion issued by Wisconsin's Attorney General limiting the DNR's power to regulate high-capacity wells.
And we'd love to know what you think about this. Has the rise in high-capacity well construction over the years affected you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you think that the DNR was overreaching its authority by rejecting permits for building high-capacity wells? Or if you're a business owner or you work in agriculture, would this change maybe help you? Call 800-642-1234.
All right, Sean. So the story so far, the Attorney General says, okay, DNR, go with what the legislature said. Take this narrower approach to your power to regulate these wells over what the Supreme Court said in a ruling the same year, both of these 2011. This is an opinion from the Attorney General. So what do we do with that? What happens with an attorney general's opinion?
So that's a good question. I mean, I think it's a big blow to environmental groups who kind of looked at this 2011 Supreme Court decision as really one of their major wins in a long string of losses for them over the past several years, as the state's put more of an emphasis on being business friendly, especially in the DNR. This was a case where environmental groups said, hey, this is a strong defense of what it means to be a Wisconsinite, to defend our public waters. So from that perspective, the Schimmel advisory opinion kind of shifts things back to what you might expect. I mean, business groups prevailed here. So what does it mean tangibly, though? Are we going to see more high capacity wells popping up? I don't know. I mean, this is Brad Schimmel is outlining what he says was the will of the legislature here and what he ultimately thinks would prevail before the state Supreme Court. But this is not a Supreme Court opinion here. This is not a law that
it's
was passed.
Precedent.
Yeah, this is an advisory opinion by the state's top lawyer. So you could speculate that the DNR might say, all right, this is what our lawyer has said is the way we should proceed now. This is how we're going to handle these high-capacity well situations. They haven't come out and said that quite so clearly, though.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Matthew on the line in New Berlin. Matthew, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I'm a private well owner, and if I had a high-capacity well that would come in my neighborhood and everybody else that has private wells, and it adversely affects us, the cost that we would incur just to have public water utilities put in would be astronomical. Some of the people who are retired on fixed incomes wouldn't be able to afford the $10,000 to $12,000 just to throw that in. But then take into consideration how it affects the natural resources and to recoup those resources after the water levels have been affected, let's just say lakes. Lake owners have water drop 2-3 feet. On some of our lakes, like Big Muskego just over here, it's extremely shallow. I would say the average depth of it is probably 4 feet. And that would be detrimental to wildlife along with recreation. So I believe that the DNR has a right to regulate that for common interests and not just businesses themselves.
Matthew, thanks for the call. And Sean, I imagine that what we're hearing from environmental groups disappointed in this opinion, I imagine they're kind of along Matthew's lines there.
Yeah, very much. And I think, you know, they'll point to that Supreme Court decision that said this is the DNR's duty. This is what we expect them to do. And that for them to act otherwise would be to basically not use the best information that they have before them. But the DNR is going to be, they're now getting conflicting advice, basically. There is this court opinion, but they now have the Attorney General telling them this is actually what would happen, or this is actually how the court should have interpreted it in light of this new and a rulemaking change passed by the legislature.
Matthew, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Julie in Green Bay. Julie, hi.
Oh, hello. I just have a comment, and I'm just wondering why the Republican legislature, who didn't like the answer that they got from the Supreme Court, went back to the Attorney General to get a different answer. And why does the Republican legislature think that they are smarter and better qualified to make a decision that affects all of us and our environment than the DNR, who are all educated in various natural resources?
Julie, thanks for the call. And Sean, some of the language I've seen from lawmakers has been along the lines of this should be in the hands of the elected representatives of the people instead of appointed bureaucrats of the DNR. Has that been the main line of argument there?
It seems like it has been, that this is their call to make, not an unelected bureaucrat is a phrase you get thrown on a lot. I mean, this conflict between legislators, more specifically Republican legislators, and the DNR is not new by any means. It goes back a long time. It is a popular agency for some lawmakers to attack in their districts, and because there's a certain amount of angst among their constituents towards some DNR decisions. And, you know, if there are some private property owners who feel like the DNR effectively gets in the way of what they want to do. The DNR's job is to manage, you know, the resources for the public, and that doesn't always jive with what a private owner wants to do.
Julie, thanks for that call. As we start to wrap up, Sean, this is just out, but a hypothetical but a very possible outcome is we end up back in court on this, an argument over high-capacity wells. It ends up coming back to the state Supreme Court. They've got their old unanimous decision. They've got this opinion from the Attorney General. What happens then?
I think it would probably be one of the most interesting cases to watch, because you wouldn't necessarily know the outcome. I mean, you could look at that unanimous decision. The court is slightly different now in its membership, but not a wholesale change there, and say, that decision is going to carry the rule of the day. But the Attorney General, who knows this court well, who has friends on the court, probably thinks that he's on to something here, and probably thinks this argument has a decent chance of prevailing.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, talking us through an opinion issued by Attorney General Brad Schimmel that limits the state DNR's powers to regulate high-capacity wells.
Coming up after the news, President Obama hopes a new moonshot effort will turn the tide on the fight to cure cancer. We'll find out how close or far we might be.
And remember, you can support great conversations, informative conversations like these, with your pledge right now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Humankind can do a lot. We went to the moon, we split the atom, and we're discovering hundreds of new planets in solar systems every year. One thing we haven't been able to do on planet Earth is cure cancer.
But that doesn't mean we're not trying. Recently, President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden announced a new moonshot effort to find a cure for what's been called the emperor of all maladies. Our next guest looked at one of the great new hopes in the fight against cancer, immunotherapy.
Van R. Newkirk II joins us now. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. His article about the Moonshot Cancer Quest is called Cancer, the Final Frontier. Van, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, President Obama and Vice President Biden recently announced a moonshot effort to cure cancer, which is something humankind has not really been able to accomplish before. How would you describe where we are right now in terms of that particular quest?
Well, I think we're, of course, closer than we have been before. We've had certain efforts. Nixon had a similar campaign where we tried to cure cancer before, but we really didn't have anything close to the science. I think now with immunotherapy, with a little bit more understanding about how genetics work, we're much closer, at least with the science, and now the policy can finally take shape to utilize that science.
So you said we're closer in terms of the science. I mean, what specific tools do we have now that we didn't have back in the 70s when Nixon was trying to get this done?
Well, the big thing that I focused on in a lot of my reporting is immunotherapy. So it basically works how your body fights off viruses or bacteria. It allows the body to recognize tumor cells as foreign and take care of them with T cells, basically. So it jumpstarts your immune system. And that's a pretty new, relatively new therapy. It has yet to be approved in a lot of cancers, in a lot of cases. And we don't quite understand certain things about how it, you know, why the body recognizes some cancers versus others. But it's probably one of the most promising parts of the oncology arsenal right now.
Well, as you said, immunotherapy is not necessarily the newest thing. It sounds like it's been around for a little while. Why is it just taking off right now?
Well, that's actually pretty new in terms of pharmaceuticals. 10, 20, 30 years generally is pretty much the window for bringing something from the experimental stages to the forefront of medicine as a mainline therapy. But I think it's taken so long to sort of catch on because I think we sort of stumbled into it. And also early therapies didn't really have sort of the financial incentive to get behind early. So a lot of the early therapies were useful in fighting very rare cancers. And very rare cancers don't make a whole lot of money for pharmaceutical companies. So there's always a financial incentive to things that work now immediately for very prevalent cancers, even if they only maybe save a month or two of life.
Well, you tell the story of a guy named Stan Collender in your piece who went through an immunotherapy trial. This was kind of a last-ditch effort for him. He had something called Merkel cell cancer. Just briefly, can you walk us through what happened to him?
Well, Merkel cell cancer is a very scary and rare cancer. Not a lot of physicians know about it. After the second or third occurrence, most doctors pretty much write patients off. So Stan was on his third or fourth occurrence, and he managed. He was a very diligent patient. He looks up all the research. He made sure to be hooked up with an oncologist at Georgetown, and from there, he was able to find out about clinical trials, and just luckily enough for him, there were clinical trials being done on Merkel cell in Seattle. So this is very much a story of not just serendipity, but also preparation. He had an amazing team, and he was very lucky enough to find the cancer early, start having treatment early, and he's very healthy. So it's really the perfect scenario.
So he basically was cured of Merkel cell, where basically he was told he wasn't going to live much longer.
Well, I think the terminology we prefer to use is durable response because we aren't sure if he's totally cured. You know, we're still pretty early in the monitoring phase. But as far as physicians know now, there's no sign of Merkel cell right now.
At what point is a cancer patient cured?
That's, I think, something that has yet to be determined because it's something that's so rare. I think what most researchers, most physicians will probably settle for is a durable response beyond a six-month time frame. That's going to be pretty revolutionary. Anything that we can do is start adding years to patients' lives instead of months. Or maybe in the case of Merkel cell, change it from a chronic disease to something that, you know, maybe you have like acute flare-ups of and you can treat it the same way over and over again. So something that becomes not something that may be destined to kill patients, but something you can just treat as it comes up.
We're talking to Van R. Newkirk II. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. And he recently wrote about the White House Moonshot Initiative to find a cure for cancer in the piece Cancer, the Final Frontier. And Van, you spent a lot of your piece talking about new partnerships that have sprung up to coordinate things like funding and research, bringing together academics and philanthropy and pharmaceutical companies. What are we seeing right now in by way of coordinated effort here?
So one of those partnerships that I focused on was the Cancer Immunotherapy Trials Network. And that's sort of the model network for a lot of places now. There are a lot of cancer centers that popped up. They all have similar funding streams. They were all founded by the same act. But there hasn't been a lot in the way of coordinating their different aims and coordinating, what they view as the most promising therapy. So the CITN, the Immunotherapy Trials Network, they say, look, we have these agents that may have some immunotherapeutic use. And we have these diseases that they might work in. And so they prioritize. And through that prioritization and through coordinating dozens of different cancer centers, universities, partnerships with pharmaceuticals, they're able to basically maximize the dollar amounts that they have to invest in prioritized agents and match them up with diseases. That's sort of a novel way of thinking about researching disease.
Right. I mean, what incentive is there for, say, a pharmaceutical company to do this when in the past maybe they choose their own path, the thing that might make them the most money, and just go after that on their own?
Well, I think what they found with the CITN is that this type of coordination dramatically cuts down a lot of the oversight and exploration costs that pharmaceutical companies have to incur in order to even begin thinking about whether a drug can be used on a certain disease. So they basically remove a lot of the barriers to entry. And I do think there's an incentive for pharmaceutical companies generally to say, look, we're fighting this disease. I don't think pharmaceutical companies are totally profit-seeking entities, nor do they want to be seen as such. So this removes a lot of the financial barriers and issues that they have and allows the researchers at pharmaceutical companies to really get behind it.
Now, going back to this moonshot effort announced by the White House, you actually call this quixotic in your piece, and you're not alone. I mean, there are critics who say that this is maybe not the most grounded piece of policy directive that the White House has put out there. But has it changed things? Has it changed the landscape of cancer research so far?
Well, yes. And I did call it quixotic, but I think the moral of the story of Don Quixote is that it's not the outcome of the fight that is the most important thing, but the fact that you consider it worthy. And I think just the idea, just the initiative of trying to coordinate our resources on cancer in the long term, even if it doesn't end up curing it, even if the science turns out that there is no one unified cure for cancer, just the act of prioritizing and coordinating across these millions and millions of dollars of research funds and agencies and people who and researchers, I think that's a worthy goal, and it definitely moves us much closer to that aim of curing it.
And the people that you talked to at some of these cancer research places and the researchers themselves, did they evince any kind of new energy about this now that wasn't there before?
Yes, and so one of the most interesting things about researching and calling a lot of the researchers is researchers are generally very cautious. They like to hedge as much as possible. We don't want to consider this a cure. Even the term durable response is a hedging term. But I think what I found among the researchers working in immunotherapy with the Trials Network is that they're very optimistic about the chances of what they do to have a long-term impact on how people live with cancer. And that's something that you rarely see, that type of unbridled enthusiasm.
So going back to Stan Collender, the guy you told us about who had Merkel cell, who has, I guess, a durable response, very durable, no signs of it so far. Is that, do you think, the kind of thing that people with more common cancers could look to have soon? What is the outlook for people who have cancer right now?
For me, I think that's probably the most realistic outcome in terms of talking about future treatments, is turning it into something that you take 6 months at a time. There's been some research showing that immunotherapy, similar to the one that Stan underwent, works in some other epithelial cancer, so lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, a couple other things, and, you know, very common cancers. And so I think if that research is translated in those areas, we're looking at maybe a future where you have cancer and you go in and see a doctor and are put on this immunotherapy drug that gives you 6 months. And maybe it comes up again later, but we can keep jumpstarting the immune system to keep you going and keep beating it.
Now, again, going back to the moonshot and some of the new infrastructure that you write about coordinating efforts, if immunotherapy doesn't turn out to be something that has broad applications for all different kinds of cancers and it dead ends in certain cases, is this infrastructure that we're seeing going to be able to be nimble enough that it can pivot and focus on the next big thing?
Well, that's a big concern, and I'm not sure since these things were sort of expressly built to handle and to promote immunotherapy, if they'd be able to handle some other therapies such as genomic therapies or combined arms approaches. They are built with the idea of finding uses for very specific pharmaceutical agents. And I think if immunotherapy proves not to be the key, I'm not sure that the next path will be something pharmaceutical necessarily.
What would it be?
Well, there's, you know, some maybe some therapies that can directly influence the genomic and gene breakdowns that cause cancer in the first place. Or there could be some breakthrough in chemotherapy, which is itself pharmaceutical, of course, but in a different sense. And maybe there's some breakthrough in how we consider and apply radiation. It could very well be that the key for curing cancer is preventing it, too, or just finding a better way to screen for it. Those are all options that are still very much on the table.
Van, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Van R. Newkirk II is a staff writer at The Atlantic. His article about the quest for a cure is called Cancer, the Final Frontier.